U.S. relative to other countries. And this concern has become so widespread that it is invariably the preface to any proposed telecom policy, be it net neutrality, rules for the 700 megahertz auction, or changes to universal service regulation. I have very strong views about the usefulness of the rankings, and in particular, the quality and accuracy of the OECD rankings that get so much attention. If you're curious about those views, you can find a copy of a presentation I gave at an event that Rob Atkinson and ITIF organized last week. That's by the door. But as an organizer and moderator of today's events, I'll keep my views to myself from here on out. If you're free to see me afterwards if you'd like to hear me rant. I'm always happy to do that. But suffice it to say that policy analysis should be based on rigorous data analysis. And while many others disagree with me about the rankings, including many of the panelists who are kind enough to join us today, most of us agree on the need for data to inform policies. I love data, but then again, who doesn't? As an empiricist, I believe there's truth in data. But to uncover those truths, you have to know what goes into the data, how they were collected, in what ways they're flawed, and what statistical techniques can tease out answers to vexing questions. With broadband, we're just beginning to scratch the surface of those questions. What do the existing data really tell us? What do they not tell us? Do we have enough data to identify market failures if they exist? Do we have the right kind of information to evaluate whether proposed broadband policies will be effective? Our distinguished panelists today represent a wide spectrum of views on these issues. I'm grateful to all the panelists for agreeing to be here, including some through very difficult circumstances. I understand that Ken Flam had to physically eject somebody from an airplane in order to go standby. And I'm looking forward to a healthy and productive discussion. Before we get started, I want to thank Brooke Glass from PFF, who makes sure that the event train not only runs on time, but runs at all, and is basically responsible for making this event a reality. And I also want to thank Jeff Ho, who, along with Brooke, makes sure that the event runs smoothly and everything works. And, of course, I have to acknowledge Drew Clark from the Center for Public Integrity. Drew has been a driving force in attempts to shed light on telecom data, even before data was in fashion. He was absolutely instrumental in pulling this event together. Some ground rules for the panels. Each speaker gets 7 minutes, which will be enforced ruthlessly via my colleague Grant, who will hold up this note sign when there are 3 minutes left, this sign when there's 1 minute left, and this wrinkled but still legible stop sign when it's time to stop. And then please hold your applause until the end of the Q&A to make sure that we have time for questions. And so with that, we'll start the first panel, which Drew will moderate. Drew?
Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate Scott's great work in helping to get this event together, to organize this event. Both of us have had a somewhat unusual and obscure interest in the wonky issue of broadband statistics, and we certainly hope that this mini-conference that is the fruit of this effort is going to put some more meat on the table about broadband statistics and issues of broadband data and how they inform telecom policy. I also wanted to make note of the fact that Scott and I have worked together in that he is on the advisory committee of the Well-Connected Project at the Center for Public Integrity. The advisory committee is a 10-person panel of telecom, media, and technology experts from across the spectrum of opinion, background, and type of work. And as you may or may not know, the Center for Public Integrity is an investigative journalism organization, and we frequently make use of the Freedom of Information Act in our work. I'll have a chance on the second panel to tell you a little bit more about what we've done in that area as regards broadband. But today, right now, we're talking about the place of the United States in the broadband world as measured by the currently available broadband data. The U.S., I've observed, has a bit of a different approach to broadband policy than many other nations. And so for that reason, I think it's very important that we have some monitoring system so we can tell, is the U.S. approach, which effectively has gone against the unbundling route that many other nations are taking is a different approach, and I think it's still an open question whether the U.S. approach or the approach that many other countries are taking will be more successful. So that does leave the question, though, how can we know whether broadband policy is successful? And I want to start off after introducing our panelists, we will go in alphabetical order, by the way. So Rob Atkinson, who is the president of the Information Technology Innovation Foundation, will go first, and he'll be followed by Kenneth Flam, who is the Dean Rusk Chair on International Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. John Horrigan is the Associate Director of Research at the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Derek Turner is the Research Director of Free Press. Joseph Waz is Vice President of External Affairs and Public Policy at Comcast. And Dennis Weller is the Chief Economist for Verizon Communications Incorporated. So for each of you, I wanted to just allow you, of course, your 7 minutes to discuss this issue. But consider this question as you make your conclusion. And it is, what is your reflection on what Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Daniel Inouye said when he introduced S-1492, the Broadband Data Improvement Act, last month? The first step in an improved broadband data policy is ensuring that we have better data on which to build our efforts. We cannot manage what we do not measure. So with that quote and with the preface that Scott has given us, I'll turn it over to Rob.
Is there a way to get this on, or what do we? What do you do? F. Okay. Perfect. I'm okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Drew. I've got 7 minutes, so I will be fast. Scott alluded to his views, so I don't want to give his views short shrift. So if you actually want to see his views, you can go to our website, itif.org, and you can view the video debate or discussion that we had about a week and a half ago at the press club, where I think he was highly articulate on his criticisms of particularly the OECD data, which I will defend a little more. I think it's really two issues with data. There's an issue of leaving aside international comparisons, there's the issue of just what kind of broadband deployment speeds, prices we have in the U.S. Why do we need that? I think we need that for several reasons. One, just to know, particularly in terms of geographic or opportunity policies, what kinds of places, what kinds of people are getting it, what kinds of places people aren't getting it. That's useful to know. We don't really have a very good sense of that right now. The best is the FCC data, which I think Ken and some other people will talk about a little more about some of the problems with that. I think an interesting source just came out 2 days ago from Communication Workers of America. I'm not sure the name of the report, but it's on their Speed Matters site. They took upload speeds and download speeds that people voluntarily did around the country and then compared by state. I think very interesting. Probably sample size could be a little bigger, but it's, I think, an interesting first step. What they found was Rhode Island had the fastest broadband, and I can't remember who was the lowest. Alaska, I think, may have been the lowest. But interesting data, which hadn't been there before. We did something similar at the state level, a report that my colleague Dan Correa helped write, a thing called the State New Economy Index, using the FCC data and combining that by state. One of the things we found is there are a lot of problems with that data set, which we had to tweak and try to correct. So I think that's an area where we need to do more, and that's partly what the Inouye proposal addresses. I think a program like Connect Kentucky, if you're familiar with that, the idea would be to create a lot more of those and get good sub-state level region data would be useful. We also filed on the FCC NOI recently, a filing that proposed an alternative, basically as a complement to what we were already doing, an idea where we wanted to build on a little bit of what the Speed Matters program did, and create this kind of bottom-up wiki-like Google Maps thing where people could go online, do a speed test. That data would get uploaded automatically to a Google Map type of system. You put your price in, you'd put what kind of provider you have in, and we would, if enough people did it, we'd have a real-time bottom-up sort of mapping system of where broadband is. You know, you could sort of build this system for a very, very little amount of money. So we think that's an interesting idea that we hope the FCC or NTIA will follow. Then the other issue is obviously international. And we've seen these numbers. We've fallen behind on broadband, at least using the OECD data numbers. There's a report that my colleague Dan Correa wrote out there on the table comparing the OECD data numbers, analyzing them, and also adding our own data, or actually other OECD data on speed and price, which I'll talk about. I think this is a political argument ultimately. Not to say there isn't an argument about the data too, but that is enmeshed in a political argument, which Drew alluded to. But I would argue the OECD data, let's just assume it's faulty, which I don't assume, but let's just assume it is. And then it was probably faulty in 2000. So we've fallen behind. I think that's really, you know, at the end of the day, you can argue whether we should be 15th or 12th or whatever it is. But we were fourth a few years ago, we're 15th now. That suggests that there's something going on there that's in the wrong direction. What are the leading complaints, excuses? I think there's a whole lot of people who sort of attack the OECD data somewhat unfairly. One is that it excludes students and workers who get broadband for free. I get broadband at work for free. Well, look, OECD data have students. I mean, the OECD countries have students. You know, I think there are students in France, probably a whole lot more than in the U.S. because they just go to school their whole lives. So I don't see why that's sort of a valid comparison. Another one is, well, we lead the world in broadband subscribers. Absolutely, we lead the world in broadband subscribers. We also lead the world in overweight people and most cars and lots of things, because we're the richest country in the world and one of the biggest countries in the world. So again, you have a denominator. There's no other policy area, data area where we would throw the denominator out. You know, by this measure, Liechtenstein will be dead last in every single measure we ever do because they're really, really tiny. Another argument, we rank more favorably on overall internet users. That's partly true. That is true, but it's largely because we have a lot of dial-up users, and other countries have migrated off of dial-up. I'm not sure that's all that something to be proud of. I think the point really that we're debating here at the apples and apples debate is, do we have broadband? Do we actually have people in broadband? Another argument we hear is that the U.S., these are simply unfair comparisons. How can we compare the U.S. against a country like Korea, where everybody lives in an apartment block? I have two things on that. One is, if you look at the speeds in Korea or Japan, I'll use Japan in particular, 75% of Japanese residents can get 100 meg fiber to the home through NTT. That's an amazing statistic. Now, what percentage of Manhattan residents can get 100 meg fiber to the apartment? The answer is zero. So it's, you know, there are places in the U.S., Lincoln Park in Chicago, parts of Los Angeles, downtown D.C. There are lots and lots of places with high-density apartment dwellings that don't get anywhere near the speeds. Secondly, when you do an analysis of broadband penetration versus urbanicity, it's a measure, again, my colleague Dan developed. I'll probably get it wrong, but it's basically the amount of metropolitanization and the density. You see that there's some correlation, but not fully. There are lots of countries that are very, very dense that don't have a lot of broadband. So I'm not saying that it's an irrelevant factor. I was just in Stockholm. They have fiber to almost every home every apartment block in Stockholm. 100 meg. I mean, it's very, very nice. And it's enabled because there are apartment blocks. I'm not saying it's not irrelevant, but I think it's overblown as an excuse. Lastly, this notion of per capita is the wrong measure. There, I actually think there's a lot of merit. The OECD data numbers are basically on broadband subscribers per capita. Now, the problem with that is that we basically have a higher household, average household size is larger in the U.S., it's larger in Korea, very small in some of the Nordic countries. So you could have 100% of the homes in some countries like that with broadband, like in Korea, and they'll never ever exceed some of the European numbers, even though 100% of the homes would have it, because you would have four or five people per home, and so when you do it per capita, you get a small number. What we did is we adjusted the OECD data numbers, came up with per household instead of per capita. When you do that, we go down to 12th instead of 15th. So I think there is some legitimacy there. We also do numbers on speed and price, which you can get there. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's see. What do I do here? Okay, my name is Ken Flam. I'm from the University of Texas at Austin. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the broadband data today. I'm a researcher who's been using broadband data or attempting to use broadband data to get insight into what is going on with broadband deployment and diffusion in the United States. The most used data, the data that is most available that most of you know about probably is the FCC data. I'm just going to talk for a moment about the FCC data and what some of its limitations are. To begin with, the FCC sort of redefined how it's collecting. The data I'm talking about to start out with is data on the number of providers by zip code that the FCC publishes. To begin with, that the basic definition was changed in 2005. And as a consequence of this change in definition and change in coverage, essentially all FCC data collected prior to 2005 are not comparable to numbers collected to 2005 and afterwards. So if you're thinking of doing any long-term analysis, you can pretty much bag it right there. So the number of providers doubled from December 2004 to June 2005, and that's not because the number of providers really doubled. It's because the definition of who had the report changed. The most important improvement in the FCC data that are now available compared to what was previously available is that so-called zero-provider zip codes are now published. Okay, prior to 2005, zip codes in which were no providers were not published. Therefore, anyone who wanted to use these data had to somehow make some kind of inference about what zip codes didn't have any providers. And the problem was that researchers who were trying to use this data for that purpose were essentially making erroneous assumptions. Basically, all research published using the FCC data prior to 2005 is wrong. It's meaningless. I'm actually one of the people who has a meaningless study out there on the market. But they're all wrong. And the reason is because the assumptions we were making, anyone could make, about zero provider zip codes were wrong. So now they do publish what their zero provider data codes are. And it turns out that they're constantly changing. Things go in and out of the FCC zip code bundle all the time for no apparent reason. So just to give you an example, the FCC, I don't have time to really talk about it in detail. Maybe if there are questions, we can talk about it later. The FCC makes a distinction between, or everyone makes a distinction between so-called point zip codes for like post offices and corporations, and geographic zip codes, which correspond to mail routes. And for example, in 41 1999 postal zip codes that were actually in the FCC statistics in June 2005 dropped out in December. Okay, just disappeared. They've been joined in with some other zip code somewhere, 20 1999 zip codes that were not used in June 2005 miraculously pop up in the December 2005 FCC statistics. Well, this is a real problem because the only thing these data are going to be any good for is tracking availability of service over time. And if zip codes come and go, like commuters in downtown D.C., well, this is going to be a problem. Now, there is one thing they could do, which the FCC has chosen not to do. There is a standard geographical layout used with government data. It's called the ZACDA, which are approximations to zip codes provided by the census. There's no reason you can't map things to ZACDAs. There are many maps of zip codes to ZACDAs that FCC could use. They just haven't chosen to do it this way. And instead, they're using this undocumented proprietary mapping system, Dynamap, which has these problems with these highly variable and fluctuating zip codes. Anyway, so Now we know what's going on, but it's not entirely a pleasant picture. The last thing I want to briefly point out is that zip codes are very large areas. Service in one corner of a zip code does not mean it's available in another corner. The typical zip code is about 3,700 households. If instead of using zip codes, we went down to zip codes plus four, we'd be down to about 10 households. And most major service providers actually do have zip code plus four data. This one change would drastically change the picture of zip code availability, or rather broadband availability in the United States. From the standpoint of individual household, the zip code numbers clearly leave much to be desired. For example, my zip code, 78731, according to the FCC numbers, there were 24 providers competing for my business in December of 2005. Well, I can tell you I have exactly one choice in my little affluent, hilly neighborhood of Austin, and it's cable. And I was very excited when I got a postcard from a satellite company last year saying, hey, we're rolling out service. Went to their website. Hasn't been deployed in my neighborhood yet. So these numbers are highly misleading. Another example, Kentucky. FCC data show 96% of the population in zip codes with broadband as of December 2004. Detailed, the Connect Kentucky survey, which you'll hear about later, shows 77%. That's quite a bit of difference. Another example, the GAO took the FCC data that were non-public, and they actually tried to work them, to sort of remove neighborhoods that didn't have that couldn't have had DSL access because they were too far from a central office switch, et cetera. And when they got through reworking it, the median U.S. providers per zip code fell from 8 to 2, and the percent of the population with no providers went from 1% to 9%. That's a pretty big difference. A third example, Vermont. So this was kind of exciting. Last fall, there was a big article in the New York Times about all the problems people were having in Vermont getting broadband access, all kinds of neighborhoods without it available. FCC says all zip codes in Vermont have broadband. So bottom line, the FCC providers per zip that you see are probably best viewed as an ordinal indicator of availability within the zip. More providers, higher probability; less providers, lower probability. The other U.S. government data, agency data that's available is not particularly helpful, by the way. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has an Internet Services Producer Price Index, which conceals more than it provides information on. Dial-up and DSL are lumped together in one category. Leased lines and symmetric DSL are in a second category. And everything else is in a third category. It's not very useful if you're interested in understanding what's going on in broadband. Furthermore, these are fixed-weight price indexes. In an industry where things are changing very rapidly, this is also not very useful. Census and Commerce basically had a supplement to the CPS they were doing once a year or every couple of years that was really the one real scientific survey with a large sample size that measured Internet access by mode and price. They discontinued it about 3 years ago. This is the only real data worth a bucket of warm spit, as I think Harry Truman said. Why did they discontinue it? The Internet is growing less important than it was, 10 years ago. There are private consulting surveys, but they have undocumented methodologies. They tend not to be consistent. I have to wrap it up here. The public Pew National Survey that John Horrigan has been kind enough to stick in questions on these issues is extremely valuable, but it's only a national survey. It can't answer geographic or regional questions. And it's also a series of one-off surveys with questions sort of coming and going. It's not really designed to track things over time. So let me conclude by just sort of showing you the differences between different cuts at the FCC data. If you think of what the FCC labels as level, what I label as level zero disconnectedness, that is absolutely no providers in a zip code, hardcore disconnectedness, you'd end up concluding that it's a very small problem. Less than 0.1% of the population for the U.S. overall, no state had more than 1% of its population in that category. If, on the other hand, you went to level one disconnectedness, which I define as less than four broadband providers in a zip code, you get a very different picture. Puerto Rico, which was one of the most connected places in the nation, is now one of the least connected places in the nation. Which is the more accurate depiction, I ask you? In any event, the point here is that the level one disconnected measure I'm talking about here more or less coincides with estimates of a population without broadband that have come from alternative sources. It seems like a conservative correlation. So nationally, the GAO says 9% in December 2004. The level one measure I constructed here is about 7%. So it's an underestimate, really, of what the GAO says. Connect Kentucky says 23% lacked access in spring 2005. versus 19% level one disconnected in June 05, according to my numbers. So they're pretty close. So the bottom line is that this is sort of a rough, I'm basically saying you can look at the SEC numbers as sort of a rough ordinal indicator of the probability of finding zip code broadband in a zip code. And if you use this as your indicator, it's not such a tiny problem. 28 U.S. states, more than 5% of the population had level one disconnectedness. In 12 states, more than 10%. In 4 states, Puerto Rico, the Dakotas, and West Virginia, more than 20% of the population. It seems to me, sort of at the intuitive level, that's a much more realistic picture of the true state of connectedness in the country than simply looking at level zero disconnectedness per the FCC. And on that lovely note, I will end my questions. So I had some suggestions, but we can talk about those in questions.
Everybody can think about the iPhone while I get my slides up. Any iPhone early adopters? Okay, fair enough. Let me try to do three things in my 7 minutes. I want to talk about trends in broadband adoption according to Pew Internet Project National Random Digit Dial Telephone Surveys of Adult Americans. Then I'm going to talk about broadband, what for. If we're worried about people having access to broadband, we should think a little bit about what people use broadband for. And then finally, challenges in data collection, particularly when thinking about doing random digital surveys of the sort we do at Pew Internet. So, trends in broadband adoption. We've been in business for about 7 years at the Pew Internet Project, and you can see a nice upwardly sloping blue line of broadband adoption in the U.S. from just a handful of percentage points in June 2000 up to 47% according to our latest data from February 2007. We're coming out with a report next week, actually, to coincide with everybody's July 4th vacations on the latest trends in broadband adoption. So you can see the steady uptick over time in broadband adoption and the decline in people with dial-up. 15% of Americans now have dial-up internet connections compared to, as you can see, 43 or 2% 7 years ago. So how does the broadband adoption rate stack up when you think about other consumer electronics technologies? So to reach 50% of the population, it took 18 years for the color TV to get to 50% of the general population. We're closing in on that for broadband adoption. 15 years for the cell phone, 14 for the VCR, 10 and a half for the CD player. And you can see that with broadband nearing that 50% mark, we're going to hit that mark in about 9 or 10 years of availability. So at least in comparing broadband adoption to other kinds of consumer electronics technologies, the adoption rate really isn't that bad. Happy dial-up users. This is actually a topic that came up a little bit in Rob and Scott's discussion at the press club a week or so ago. Some people with dial-up just seem content to stick with it. 60% of dial-up users say they don't really want to switch to broadband, which is actually a figure that stayed constant over three different surveys in which we asked that question from 2002 to 2005. What that means, actually, if you really do the math, is that if the same number of people are saying, same number of dial-up users are saying they don't want broadband, and the number of dial-up users is declining over time as it did between 2002 and 2005, it does mean that people's preferences are changing. Some people with who said they were content with dial-up in 2002 are going into the camp of people saying, well, I'd really like to get broadband if I could. And that's likely because as people get more internet experience, they tend to do more things online and thus have higher levels of demand for broadband. Nonetheless, speed does matter when you start to compare activities of what people do online between dial-up internet users and high-speed internet users. These are some bullet points in which you can assume, because I did do the analysis, we're holding everything constant, people's demographic characteristics, the amount of years people have been on the internet. if you have a high-speed internet connection, it's definitely a door opener to doing more things on the internet, spending more time with the internet, and likely spending less time watching television, and according to time use studies, less time sleeping. The second set of bullet points is just a very brief recounting of, well, what do people use broadband internet for? People who use the internet, and particularly people who have high speed at home, use that connectivity to maintain their social networks. Getting information. Obviously, the internet's an informational tool, but people who have high-speed internet connections show higher levels of civic engagement. They tend to get their news on the internet with greater frequency, particularly among young people. It's an extremely important source for news that replaces offline sources for news. People with high-speed internet connections show higher levels of attitudinal measures with respect to doing transactions with government. And finally, we've done some studies that show that not only did the information from the internet help in major life decisions, there's sort of a two-pronged effect. It helps you get information to make those decisions, and it helps you activate your social networks, which often can be a pathway to helping you make decisions about healthcare, financial decisions, and job search and the like. So the question is, if speed matters, does more speed matter? And that's actually when doing random digital telephone surveys starts to get a challenge, to be a challenge in my line of work. It's hard to rely on self-reports on people's network speed. We asked people in one survey, broadband users, whether they know what their connection speed was. You can see that four-fifths of broadband users didn't know what their connection speed was. And if I were to rely on the 17% who said, yes, I know what my speed is, I probably wouldn't get very far in terms of relying on their actual self-reports on what their network speed is. Finally, turning to challenges in terms of understanding how people are using broadband in their personal lives, which is often not only a key input to policy deliberations, it's a key input for nonprofits and other organizations trying to improve their service delivery with broadband. We have to do a better job going forward with measuring network speed and quality of service for people. Again, that's something that random digital telephone surveys can do to some extent, but not as crisply as one would like. We'd like to know about network availability. Ken talked about that. We're going to talk about that much more, so I won't linger on that point too much. And finally, this is the point about cell phone only users. It's a challenge to everybody doing telephone surveys these days. It's, I think, a somewhat more serious problem for people doing random digital telephone surveys about technology usages. We do at the Pew Internet Project. Most of the time, the sample you get in doing a random digital telephone survey does not include cell phone numbers, which means you're missing the growing segments of the population who don't have landlines at home. They just have cell phones. There are ways to address that. It's more expensive for survey researchers. It is possible to get cell phone numbers in samples. It's trying to figure out how to do some of the more involved weighting techniques is a continuing challenge for the research business, but it's something that looms down the road. I've gotten the stop sign, so I will conclude. Thanks.
So these type of things, I rarely ever put it together a slide presentation because by the time I get up, everyone else has already said what I was going to say, so it leaves me a little room to ad lib, which I'll do a little bit today. I'm going to talk a little bit about why we even care about broadband data in the first place. As a matter of public policy, we've collectively decided that, and at every level of government, local, state, federal, that communication technologies are a critical component to our national economic well-being, our local economic well-being, and our social well-being. And this is essentially the bedrock principle contained in the Communications Act to make available to all people adequate facilities at reasonable charges. So broadband, or advanced telecommunications capability, as I like to call it, is two-way capability. and it's the ultimate converged communication technology which enables anyone with access to it to engage in the traditional activities of communication, like sending a letter or engaging in a phone call. But it also allows you to be a radio broadcaster, a video broadcaster, a print reporter, a publisher, or even a retail store owner. But its biggest potential lies in its power to truly democratize the media. If we have two-way, truly high-speed, available and used broadband networks, then the traditional gatekeepers of information lose some of their power, and rightly so, give it back to the people. So that's why we care about broadband data. So to promote universal and affordable access and adoption, we need to know the supply factors that determine deployment, and we need to know the demand factors that determine adoption. I mean, as John just showed, 60% of dial-up users are saying that they're satisfied with a dial-up connection. I assume a lot of those people probably have broadband available to them. Well, why are they satisfied? Is it that broadband's too expensive, or is it more that they just don't see it as a valuable product? So we need to know those factors, and we also need to know how the market is changing over time, and we need to know all this not at the national or state level, but we need to know it at the local level. Now, this is something that Congress envisioned when broadband was in its infancy. The public policy goal of universal deployment is explicitly stated in Section 706 of the Act, which directs the FCC to determine, quote, whether advanced telecommunications capabilities being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. And when they said the term advanced telecommunications capability, they were very specific about that. They defined it as broadband telecommunications capability that enables users to originate and receive high-quality voice, data, graphics, and video telecommunications using any technology. So this language is what motivates the Form 477 data that Ken talked about. And the data produced by it is by far the best and most comprehensive source of information that we have on the U.S. broadband market. But the information it collects does not enable the Commission to adequately fulfill its mandate under 706. Now, before I talk about what is wrong with 477, I should mention the aspects of the form that are very useful. Data is gathered every 6 months. Given that it's essentially a census of all lines, to get that kind of data every 6 months is pretty amazing. In theory, it enables time series quasi-experimental analysis, but as Ken showed, the fact that they changed the methodology, you know, two-thirds of the way through the gathering process has sort of skewed that a bit. The data, for the most part, is separately reported for residential connections, and I think it's extremely important to monitor how broadband is being deployed and adopted in homes independent of what's going on in businesses. The data is reported for each different type of technology, and this is very important because it gives us an idea of the state of competition, though, as I'll say in a second, a very incomplete picture. The data is now reported by all providers of broadband. Prior to 2005, you were exempt from reporting if you were a small provider only serving 250 customers, so that's a good improvement. And there's now some speed data reported, though I'll discuss shortly how that's not been properly implemented. And most of the data is reported at the state level. And, of course, this is not the granularity we need, but it does allow informative comparisons. And I say most states because for some of the data, they, for reasons of confidentiality, censor the data and don't provide anything. For example, we only recently learned in the most recent round of data the number of residential connections in Hawaii, which it turns out that Hawaii actually has the highest household-level penetration of any state in the U.S. So that would have been good information to have before. And the FCC is now reporting the percent of ILEC and cable lines that are broadband-capable at the national and state level, and this actually is a key step forward in them adequately implementing 706. But 477 has many shortcomings. Ken talked about a lot of that. The first and most glaring is it provides very little information about deployment and provides no information about deployment at a local level. If you recall, the reason they're even doing 477 is so the FCC can write its Section 706 reports on the status of reasonable and timely deployment of broadband to all Americans. It has the word deployment in it. The FCC's only metric for deployment is the malign zip code methodology, something we could probably have a week-long conference on. The data completely ignores upload speeds, completely. The language of 706 is quite clear. Congress envisioned the future in 1996, they envisioned the future as a two-way communication technology, a symmetrical world. And if you actually go back and look through some of the testimony that was being given from 92 on about what was being promised, the vision of the future, it was essentially a symmetrical fiber future is what was being promised at the time. And it certainly wasn't the 256 or 384 kilobit upload speed world that we live in now. We have no information about household adoption at the local level. Like I said, we can use it to 477 to calculate state-level household adoption, but this granularity is too limited for the purpose of public policy research. One way that could be improved is by requiring providers to report actual subscriber counts so you could calculate penetration at a more local level. And they could do it on the census track. If you look at State of California and their franchise bill, they're actually requiring anyone who applies for a statewide franchise to report at the census track and census block level, and providers are complying with that. So it's not as if it's an impossible task. We have no ability to talk about competition at the local level. And I've seen many who've used the zip code data to try and portray a robust competitive marketplace all across the country, but Ken's work shows that that's not the case. GAO's work shows that's not the case, and it's vastly overstated. Ken's example is very stark. Mine, I live across the street from the West Falls Church Metro Station here in D.C. My zip code says I have 13 providers. I have one available to me. I have cable. Two blocks away, you can get Fios. For me, you can only get cable. Furthermore, the number of providers, even if we know the number of providers at the census tract level, it's not a good true measure of competition. We need market share data. We need to know HHIs. We need to know four-form concentration ratios. It doesn't matter if there's one provider serving one customer and the other 1,000 customers on the block are served by another provider. That's not competition. We need to do something about the treatment of cell phones. Many of you probably have BlackBerries with data plans. Is that really the same thing as a true substitutable product for your landline connection? I would argue that it's not. Of course, there's no information on price or price changes over time. The speed data is an improvement, but their bin sizes are too narrow, and it's a mistake to lump in business connections with residential connections. And to close, to answer Drew's question, yes, we can measure something if we don't adequately know, but we're not going to get it right. We're not going to get the policy right, and we're going to end up making a lot of mistakes. Thanks.
Morning, everybody. Another low microphone.
Too strong.
Steve, real loud. Is that the answer? Can everybody hear me? Would somebody like to? And I'll start so I don't waste my 7 minutes. I want to start off with a couple of data points about what the cable industry, but one size doesn't fit all, obviously, is the message today. A couple data points about what the cable industry has done to promote broadband in America. First, I'll state unequivocally that no one offered broadband to residential users in the United States before cable did. We started the broadband revolution in American homes and are very proud of it. And we did started that revolution by investing over $116 billion to date in fiber optics and electronics to get this out there. Comcast alone, my company alone, has invested over $50 billion to bring the broadband future to American homes. And finally, according to Kagan Research, which is the foremost data source for the cable industry, cable is making broadband available today, right now, to 94% of all American homes. So we're going to be awash in ideas today for new ways to gather data, new ways to assemble and analyze it. I'll say data are interesting, but assembling new data takes time, it takes money, it takes human resources, it takes the attention of regulatory bodies and Congress, and it takes the money of foundations. So either we need to, in the quest for new data, we need to make sure that we're making the best possible expenditure of all these resources, and we need to decide what problem it is we're trying to solve before we start down the road of collecting more data. If we're accumulating data mainly for the purpose of refuting the OECD report or we don't like our ranking in there, that's a waste of time. The State Department, the Commerce Department, Commissioner McDowell, everybody else has pointed out all the flaws and inconsistencies in the OEC data. And we should really just focus on what we need the data for, what we're trying to achieve. What are the two things I think we're trying to achieve? First of all Americans getting timely access to broadband, meaning access to a network, the ability to connect, going by the front door? If not, why not? What can we do about it? And second is, are all Americans taking advantage of access to broadband? Are they buying it? If not, why not? And what can we do about it? What should we do about it? So let me start with the first question. I think the answer is, for most Americans, yes, they are getting access to broadband. I think that's been demonstrated even in the data this morning. The FCC is now proposing to do more granular data collection. The nine-digit zip code level, as Dr. Flam pointed out this morning, can get us much better data. Our industry, the cable industry, supports collecting at the zip plus four level. We also think it makes sense to collect information on all forms of broadband, wireline and wireless,
And I think Rod Atkinson has proposed that at least at the lowest tier, we split the 200 kilobit to 2.5 megabit tier in half. I think was it the 768 level, Rob, or the 1 meg level you proposed? No problem with that. I think that's a reasonable proposal. But we also strongly support the need to preserve the confidentiality of this data. This is a competitive market, about which I'll say more in a second. This is competitively sensitive data, and we need to find the right balance between giving the FCC the data they need to know to pursue public policy goals and the interests of preserving competition and encouraging competition in the marketplace. So I think the single most important piece of data we're looking for and should focus on is where broadband isn't. And we need to move on from other broadband agendas that have preoccupied this town for too long and really focus on how can we serve those who are unserved today by broadband, and how can we achieve that without raising people's taxes, bloating the Universal Service Fund, or creating disincentives to competition and innovation. And this is really where our energy and our best thinking should be directed. It's hard work. It's not as much fun as some of the other debates that we like to engage in the broadband space, but it's where attention must be paid. So answer the second question, are people accepting broadband? Unquestionably they are. We can't provision broadband fast enough to our consumers. It's still the fastest growing communications product of all time. If people aren't accepting it, it's a marketing problem, or they don't yet see the value in it. Some reference made to happy dial-up users this morning. They may be the nevers for broadband. Believe it or not, in cable and satellite, there are still never households. 15% of American homes don't take cable or satellite after 40 years for a variety of reasons. So there may be homes where broadband just isn't going to be welcome. But at least accessibility to broadband should be universal. I want to react to a couple of the presentations this morning. Rob Atkinson's idea of a complementary sort of wiki speed and price measurement system is an interesting one, but I think all the panelists will concede there are huge challenges in measuring speed, in comparing apples to apples for speed between providers in the U.S. and between the U.S. and abroad. The PC Magazine just did a major surf speed survey that was published earlier this month, and they've already had to run a large editor's note as to why they're reconsidering their outcomes and going to change their model the next time around. It's hard to get good, credible, reliable data about broadband speeds because there's so many variables involved. Not to say we shouldn't keep trying, but nobody's really come up with the magic bullet yet to figure out exactly how to do it. I've already spoken to John Horrigan's point about the happy nevers. I think a big question on broadband, what for, which is what John teed up this morning, is what are people using broadband for? And then I think the related question is what are citizens of South Korea, and I hope the panel and the audience will address this, what are the citizens of South Korea, Japan, and Iceland who are supposedly getting very high speeds on broadband? How are their lives, are their social circumstances measurably different? What are the applications they're using? What is it they're doing with broadband that is that puts them ahead of the United States? Is it speed alone, or is there value, a unique value that they're enjoying that Americans are not? So whatever the data are, I think the data that we have today bring us to several points. First, more private sector investment in broadband networks by both new providers and established providers, wireline and wireless, is a great thing for this nation. The focus should be on breaking down barriers, letting people invest and compete, and let broadband grow. Secondly, as the Federal Trade Commission concluded yesterday, before we start regulating in the area of broadband, the watchwords are caution, 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 quoting the agency. Third, I think we should really resist the continuing temptation to want to set national speed goals for broadband. Every company that's investing in broadband services wants to deliver services of which speed is one component that consumers want at a price they're willing to pay in a competitive marketplace. We're not in a monopoly rate of return world where a single incumbent can go out and invest unlimited amounts of money and get a gold-plated rate of return. We're in a competitive world where, frankly, I think we've made an incredible amount of progress in broadband up to this point. And I can assure you that every broadband provider wants to provide the speeds consumers want and the services they want at the price they're willing to pay. I hope you all had a chance also to see on YouTube Brian Roberts' presentation of wideband at the cable show. If you haven't, take a look at it. It's about 9 minutes long. It's the 100 to 150 megabit future that we want to get to as quickly as the marketplace will allow. Thank you.
my skills. Okay, that's not it. There we go. All right, thank you. Well, good morning. Well, there's a long-running soap opera that recurs in Washington. We get a new set of episodes about every 6 months when the OECD statistics come out again. emergency rooms around the Washington area fill with wrist injuries attributable to excessive hand wringing. As you see, the latest numbers were about number 15. People ask, why aren't we number one? Well, as with most soap operas, the plot doesn't necessarily correspond to reality, although here in Washington, sometimes the opposite can be true. Many people look at the OECD statistics and want to see something like household penetration of broadband, but of course that's not what they are. That's an interesting color inversion. The yellow, which shows as blue on my... chart is U.S. states. The blue are EU countries. These all come from household surveys done about the same time last year, where you call people up and ask, do you have broadband in your home? And there's some observations. Let's see if there's some. There we go. Instant animation. The U.S. average, which is taken from John's survey, actually, considerably higher than the EU average. 8 out of the top 10 observations on this chart are U.S. states. And the lowest ranked state, West Virginia in the U.S., is above the EU average. So we're sort of Lake Wobegon in that sense. So I think if we compare to the data that sort out some of the problems we've talked about with the EU data, with the OECD data, in fact, there's no evidence that the U.S. is behind in broadband. And there's lots more information we could present, but in 7 minutes I'm not going to. Instead, let's talk a little bit about what things we would like to know and why. And I can think of three purposes for this data. One is for people here in Washington to beat one another up with, so let's set that one aside. Second might be to understand the workings of the market a little better as opposed to just ranking countries. And the third might be the one that Joe was just talking about, which is actually trying to get broadband out to people who don't have it, which is probably the most important one. So I'm going to do this one fairly quickly so I can get to that last one and spend more time talking about that. What things would we like to know? And this really comes under the heading more of supplementing, say, OECD data rather than really changing it. One is sorting out business. The OECD, because most of its countries don't report business and residents separately, they lump them together. And it appears that there's a fair amount going on in business that we don't understand in the data. For one thing, most of us have instant on, always on, high-speed access in our offices, but it has nothing to do with anything called DSL or cable modem service, and the OECD doesn't count it. Although if it did, then the OECD would count it. So, A, it's a large left-out part of the market, and B, there's good reason to believe that technology choices in this matter differ across OECD countries, so there's also a bias. For example, leased lines basically for a long time have been cheaper and more widely available here than in most other OECD countries, so I think you've had widespread adoption of this methodology long before broadband even became a major factor in the market, and that's less true in other countries, so that's a bias that might be interesting to look at. The composition of business, we know that intensity of broadband use is going to vary by size and by industry segment. Think of SIC codes. So I think some finding out how much explanatory power that has in looking at data across country might be interesting. A lot of people have talked about the issues of density and concentration, so I'm going to skip over that a little bit. Composition, if we look back at this chart, notice that the small observations are at the ends. The Netherlands is at the high end. Greece is at the low end. France and Germany are in the middle, which is sort of where you expect larger units to be because you have averaging going on within those larger units. Here in the U.S., when we talk about universal service, we're familiar with this in the phenomena of study area averaging. So some thought about that would probably be useful. demographics, household size, age, income. Household size, somebody's already talked about. Billy Jack Gregg, the consumer advocate from West Virginia, tells me that the relatively low ranking of his state is attributable to the fact that it has relatively high average age of heads of household and relatively low income. Again, it would be interesting to sort through some of these variables and start to understand how much each of them explains of the variations that we see across geographic units, whether they're countries or segments of countries. Again, the OECD generally doesn't count wireless in, except in those cases where it decides that it will. Wireless devices are a rapidly growing component of the market here, so it would be good to understand more about that. Again, there's lots more that we could say about this, but in 7 minutes, I'm not going to. Again, interesting color variations here. But we talked a little bit about comparison, say, between us and other countries. First, let's compare investments we're making to those of other companies in the U.S. Happens to be the case that over the last few years, Verizon has had a larger investment program than any other company in the United States economy, not just telecom company, but any company. So bigger than GE, bigger than Exxon. These are companies that are several times larger than we are. Now, we've added recently to this chart numbers for telecom operators from other OECD countries. You see in the middle there, operators who are about the same size as we are, France Telecom, DT, substantially less investment. The two leaders in investment worldwide are NTT and Verizon over the last few years. And Rob made some comparisons with Japan. It's interesting to see that that's not because NTT has outspent us. It's because, given the demographics, they've gotten more bang for the buck. They've been able to pass more households and sign up more customers for roughly the same expenditure, not more. Now, that leads me to this chart, which I'll go through fairly quickly. This shows distance, the proportion of customers on the top chart there on the left, proportion of customers in each country that lie within a given distance of the central office. So, for example, in Italy, which is the topmost band there of the line, 80% of the customers lie within 2 kilometers of the central office. For the U.S., it's only 20%. So unless that program to get everybody to move out of the countryside and into the town starts taking effect, we just have a different set of facts to deal with. This chart, which I stole from France Telecom, shows that DSL is a very distance-sensitive technology. You can do well and get fairly high speeds if you live across the street from the central office, but not if you live very far away. So what this means is that some other OECD countries have been able to make early gains by bolting DSLAMs, basically electronics, onto the existing copper technology, and that's helped them up to a certain point, but eventually they all reach the limits of that technology. The last thing I want to cover very quickly is really the most important point, which is the most important use of data. I think that there are some fundamental limits to what you can do with nationwide carrier reporting with a standard reporting form. We have certain information in our billing system, and that's what we have to report, basically. Ultimately, the gathering and use of the data should be integrated. If the objective is to see where we don't have broadband and to get broadband out to people, there ought to be a program where the data gathering is for the purpose intended. And I think what we're going to hear next panel from someone from Connect Kentucky showing the success of very localized public-private partnerships that are basically on the ground and looking at local conditions, know who the players are in the way that NTIA and the FCC here never are going to, and then can have various means, once they identify areas that need more broadband, of bringing those together. I think something that a lot of us agree with on the panel, I think, would agree on is that that shouldn't be the current universal service system, which is very inefficient, not targeted very well. We're mainly paying people to do things that they would otherwise do anyway. And Connect Kentucky doesn't do that. It tries to improve the business case through demand development of various kinds, demand aggregation, matching private investment with these areas where they identify need, and they've had a good record of success in doing that. And finally, supplementing the big business case with tax and other incentives using existing funding sources. Now, on a national basis, policy may focus on trying to expand that model to other states, and that's one thing that federal funding could be used for. And another idea might be using this ground-level activity in each state as a kind of farm system to identify areas where you really need some additional help. In other words, hey, we've tried to polish this business case as much as we can, and we still can't get anybody to come in and do it. And that might float projects up where they could be funded by some other agency, maybe the RUS if it gets reformed sufficiently, not the Universal Service Fund. This is where I think we can learn from other OECD countries, because this process does go on in other OECD countries. No other OECD country uses its Universal Service Fund to promote the availability of broadband. So if people want to learn from the OECD, that might be a way of doing it. And finally, without exception, these projects in other countries are done on the basis of competitive bidding. How else would you want to give out a contract to build local infrastructure? And I think it's important that there is a shift in incentives from the ground rule, grassroots states, where you're talking about a Connect Kentucky kind of model. You want to give that a chance to work without telling every participant that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if they say no at the early stages of these discussions. And so I think the penalty for having this float up to the federal level has to be that it's opened up for competitive bidding to all parties. So somebody who's developing a project, say with a Kentucky kind of organization, can say yes in those discussions and gain the advantage of going ahead and doing it. If they say no, they have the possibility of federal funding, but they know that they're going to have to compete for it. And I will end there. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. Wonderful presentations. Since we have a limited time for questions, I will go ahead and just open it straight up to the audience. If you do have a question, please raise your hand, and we have some microphones, and identify yourself, and we'll go from there. Yes, right here.
Hello, my name is Don Wong. Couple of the bullets on these presentations include speed matters, and I would like to add two more. One is access matters and cost matters. For example, if I get in a car in my house, I can drive to this location in 20 miles. I don't have DSL broadband access. I've been asking for it since the Communications Act of 1996, there were a proliferation of DSL providers, including Bell Atlantic and Verizon. They can't tell me when they will have broadband DSL access available. So I'm forced to go to cable. And that's what I mean. Access is important. Cost is important, because if only cable broadband is available, then I have no choice except to use cable. Thank you.
Okay. Was there let me direct that as a question to Well, let's go ahead and actually take some more questions, because we have a lot of them out here. Yes, right up here in the second row.
Hi, I'm Ann Beigel with Communications Daily, and my question is really for Mr. Weller and Mr. Waz. There's a lot of attention on collecting broadband data and a lot of discussion on the panel about statistics, but I believe the bigger issue is whether or not your companies are monopolies or quasi-monopolies. And I would like you to tell me how you assess the political momentum for a broadband data bill, which I believe would be the step before action taken to subsidize further entry of competition.
Well, I'll start if I could. I don't think that there is a remaining or at least an unchallenged monopoly in the video world, in the voice world, or in the data world today. And if you need any better proof of that, pick up the paper, watch the ads on TV, look at the banner ads that Dennis's company and my company are pushing at you every way we can, look at the pricing competition going on in the bundles to try to get maximum penetration in the marketplace for the three services. The competition, wireline competition today, unquestionably is driving and is going to drive more quickly the penetration of broadband and the penetration of competitive voice services and the penetration of competitive video services as Verizon and AT&T get into that space. So I think we can common sense says that the days of monopoly are gone in those three markets. The chances of a broadband data bill, we've been working with the Hill on supporting efforts to collect better data. We're working with the FCC as well. I think I laid out some of our parameters this morning on that. But the question, the key question is always going to be what data for what purpose at what cost. And that's where we'll want to work with the agency and the Hill to say, what is the end we're trying to establish here? The number one goal of this nation should be to figure out where broadband isn't, and the right, and then the policy follow-on to that is, how do we get it available there?
Go ahead.
Can I just add a little bit to that? I won't repeat everything Joe said about company. All I can say is that what motivates us every day in every business decision we make is intense competition with these guys, with three national wireless carriers, with 3G, with a fourth about to appear. Roughly a third of the fixed wireless spots in the world are in the United States. So, I mean, there's an awful lot going on that we can't afford to ignore, and our efforts have been really to refashion our company. We wouldn't be investing the kind of dollars that I showed you on that chart if we thought that we didn't have competition. Then the question is, what data and sort of what's the suitability to the purpose of the data? I think collecting national broadband statistics has limited usefulness on the basis of carrier reporting. There's a limit to how much detail. We don't know much about the demographics of the household. We know where we mail a bill, so it depends on how many digits there are in the zip code that are in our billing system. We don't really know whether it's business or residence. We know whether, and if you look at the instructions for the 499, it's basically, is this an offering that's primarily aimed at business or primarily aimed at residence? So there are some inherent limitations that are always going to be there in a carrier reporting system. That isn't to say we shouldn't refine that system, but a lot of our information is going to have to come from other places. A couple people mentioned the census, which is probably the best organized scientific sample that we once have and now don't, and I think one of the best federal policy changes that we could have would be to instruct the Census Bureau to start doing something useful in that regard again. And then the final thing, I think what most of us really have in mind is detailed information about the availability of broadband, and that's much better collected on a micro basis through the sort of Connect Kentucky model than on a national basis. A lot of the players that Connect Kentucky deals with are never going to fill out a federal reporting form. And they may not know that they're supposed to, or if they do, the FCC is never going to go after them. What you need is people at ground level in the local area who know who the players are and could deal with reality rather than with aggregated reporting at a national level.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to the fourth row there.
Hi, I'm Peter Backoff. I'm with the Alliance for Public Technology. And I guess I'm going to refine that question a little bit for Mr. Waz and Mr. Weller in the sense that, so I think as Mr. Turner pointed out, there's a federal mandate that we get universal service to people. And so I think in terms of comparing the data that we collect for this as opposed to, say, VCRs or CD players, which we don't mandate universal distribution of, then it seems like we have a more special need to sort of collect, as the gentleman mentioned, access data in terms of speed and price. And so I just wanted to ask you guys, how do you feel about collecting data on speed and price? Do you think that's important, and how should that be done? So.
Well, again, I think on speed, there are clearly some challenges, and I hope some of the other research experts on the panel will speak to some of those. But when an institution as reliable as PC Magazine has to rethink its approach, when we look at what the release that came out from Speed Matters the other day, when you're using IF reported data versus actual measured data for Speed Matters, you're comparing apples and oranges. I checked with Rob this morning on that, and Rob confirms that comparing apples to apples, the U.S. Median speed is 4.8 meg per second. So if you get those kinds of variations, it suggests there's a lot of work to be done on coming up with an effective speed measure. You have to take into account all the variations, processor speed of the computers, server speed from the provider, the backbone, what's the weakest link in your connection, whether the home is using wireless or not, the direct wireless connection is as fast as the wireless, and whether there are multiple users in the home, because if my kid is downloading something while I'm accessing, I'm not going to get a reliable speed measure. So there's a lot to be figured out in terms of how you can creatively, effectively, reliably measure speeds. And then the related question is speed to what end? It goes back to the second question I raised in my presentation. If broadband speeds are serving the needs of Americans, and if the next generation of applications develops somewhere that drives more investment in speed, there will be more investment in speed. No question about it. I think the biggest challenge for this nation is one we've been talking about for 6 or 7 or 8 years now, is where are those apps? Globally, where are those apps that are going to drive the next generation of speed? We want those apps to come. We want to deliver more value to consumers. So speed, you know, just measuring speed for the sake of measuring speed is not going to get us much of anywhere.
Do you have a quick thing to add, Dennis? Because I want John Horgan to get in here, too.
Well, a couple things. One is customers, beyond fairly sophisticated ones, often aren't very aware of what they're getting. So surveys are a limited way of doing that. Carrier reporting is also a limited way, because if you could organize that, you'd get the advertised speed. And sometimes that's what you actually get, and sometimes it's not. It varies by all that sort of variables. Some of those that he listed are in the control of the consumer. Some of them are in the control of the consumer. Now, generally, when we've been tested, we try to provide a premium product, and we provide pretty good backhaul and things like that. So generally, our services test out at the advertised speed, but that's not always the case. And it's not clear how the FCC or some central reporting agency would corral that. So I think you're talking really about specific studies that are designed for the purpose, actually. The one other thing I'd say is that I think you hear about a lot of disparagement about measuring low speeds, but the fact is there are a lot of different applications in different situations out there. I think capturing differentiation in speed is a good idea, but there are going to be a whole host of new applications coming up that may have different speed requirements. Your refrigerator is not going to be watching full motion, you know, video interactively, okay? But you may want to know that that connection is there and that it's playing a role in the environment, okay? So there are lots of things, reasons to want to know things, and there isn't a uniform piece of data that's going to tell you that.
John, why don't you go ahead and jump in here?
Quick comment on the speed issue. It's, on the one hand, a technical question in terms of how you measure it and how you measure it correctly, and then as a challenge for social scientists as to how to handle the data once it's done and hopefully done correctly. I think it's a challenge that the National Science Foundation ought to think about in terms of the research challenge. So I would say if the Inouye bill doesn't or isn't asking the National Science Foundation to look into the issues of speed and how to do it correctly, it should be asking NSF to do that work.
We've got a lot of interest here. Just 10 seconds for Ken and then for Rob, and that's another question.
Yeah, 2 points. One on, you know, why are we collecting this data? I have to concur that ultimately the reason is to understand why, what areas aren't getting broadband deployment and why, or what areas, you know, there may be areas that are so poor that people just wouldn't buy it even if it were there. So how do you understand what's going on? The only way to understand it is to have reasonable data linked to the demographic, socioeconomic variables, and try to sort of model in some way what is happening so you understand it, right? So the bottom line is this isn't rocket science. It's not terribly difficult. There is demographic and socioeconomic data out there that's publicly collected every 10 years called the census. There's also economic censuses that come out every 5 years. There's no huge rocket science involved here in sort of linking the data that's being collected anyway by the FCC for broadband to the demographics. Is just a question of doing it properly and using categories that are meaningful for the socioeconomic data. And perhaps, you know, if we drove it down to the ZIP plus fours, which is a very easy thing, I think, for all the companies to do, okay, because you use it when you bill, right?
Well, sorry, we just didn't.
Okay. Let me ask a question that gets to some of these issues, which is, I thought you said that ZIP plus 4 is something that you could do, Dennis, and Joe certainly endorsed that concept. But
I didn't, actually.
That's right.
We have the set ZIP codes in our system that our customers give us. We can go and try to assign ZIP plus 4 to them, which would be a fairly large effort for, you know, the many millions of customers that we have. And then the question is, how accurately can you map those to how accurately do you get them? And how accurately do you match them to other data sources? And frankly, it seems to make more sense to gather data accurately through other systems. I mean, if you did it through the census, for example, you get it according to the same categories, that the same geographic categorization that the census uses already.
Ken, does it matter whether you use ZIP plus 4 or census block, or are you saying you can do either one?
Well, I mean, this is, again, we're kind of obfuscating the issue here. There's multiple correlations. Now, they're not exact, but there's multiple correlations available that can correlate ZIP plus 4s with census blocks, and zips with census blocks. And, you know, if you want to collect it, so you're saying go have the census do it. Well, that's fine, but the census isn't funded, and the FCC is to collect this data, basically. So, you know, the census certainly isn't going to collect it every 6 months. Okay, the census demographics are now collected every 10 years. The census economic data is collected every 5 years, okay? So the FCC is mandated to do a thing twice a year, basically. So, you know, saying, well, have the census do it. Well, the census was doing a halfway credible job for a while, but they were defunded. So you guys can get out there and sort of pound on the – believe me, I think you folks have a fair amount of influence over with the with getting these numbers out. So I urge you to you know, to fund the census then to do this. We're talking about one supplemental survey a year for the CPS. It's not a big deal. The Commerce Department
Let's go ahead and get two more questions in here if we could. So one on this side in the back, and then another one on the back from this side.
Hi, I'm Bruce Hahn with the American Homeowners Grassroots Alliance. A data point that nobody spoke to was consumer perceptions of the speeds they're actually getting. Isn't it important to know how happy consumers are with the speeds they're actually getting? Whether it's 2 megabits a second, if 98% of people are happy with that, it's a very different matter than if 20% are happy with that. Isn't that some data point that needs to be collected if it's not already? Question for any of you.
Go ahead, John.
Take a stab at that since that's information we have tried to collect. And we did find that, as the slide said, 17% of broadband users can actually answer the question, what kind of speed am I getting? 80% don't know what kind of speed they're getting.
No, they know whether they're happy or not.
Yeah, I mean, we've asked those questions in the past, and you know, broadband, we haven't asked it in a while. When we asked it early on in the adoption phase of broadband, broadband users are extremely satisfied when you ask them what they think of their quality of service. Because they've gone from the 5600 baud modem to a high-speed connection, yeah, they think it's a lot better. It's always on. So generally, people tend, in self-reporting, to be satisfied with their broadband speeds.
All right. Ken, very quick comment.
You know, the speed, there's never going to be a satisfactory resolution of the speed issue, quite frankly. I mean, the speed in your connection, it's going to depend on your technological means of connecting and whether the congestion in the system. It's going to depend on what you're trying to connect to and where you're trying to connect to. It's going to depend on whether there's a local Akamai server that's sort of downloading pages that have been cached that aren't, you don't have to go, and whether there's one in your area or not. There's a zillion variables. You're never going to get a completely satisfactory, neutral, objective speed measure that isn't affected by all of those things. The best you're going to be able to do is sort of the maximum download rate, perhaps, or upload rate, given the technological, which the companies do know, but they're not going to guarantee that speed because it's content dependent. I mean, there's no...
It seems to be a very fuzzy number, no matter how you slice it. I promised Rob 10 seconds, last question.
Two things. One, I was really happy when I went to my 2 or 3 meg DSL from my dial-up, and I thought I was really happy until I got Fios, and I realized how unhappy I was when I had 2 meg. Now I'm really happy with my 15 meg Fios. On the speed thing, I guess I don't agree, and I don't agree with several points we made. I think it is easy to get speed data. The speed matter, you can do a speed test. You're not dealing with caching. You're not dealing with anything else. It's a pretty good measure if you go through good speed test systems. I get my Fios at 15 meg, and I want to complain to Verizon because when I do my speed test, it's 14.99. Now, can I get you with the FTC on that? But I do think that you can get very good speed if you go through good speed test servers, and then we upgraded that as we proposed in our FCC filing.
Okay, I think we have one last question in the back.
Yeah, I want to elaborate on this speed question. Questioners have asked.
Just identify yourself.
Jim Snyder from the New America Foundation. Where I see the debate at is I think there's a consensus that the gold standard for measuring broadband would be dollars per bits penetration data if we could get it. Second point that there's consensus on is it's incredibly difficult to get reliable speed data, so that's sort of hopeless. And the third point is that the advertised rates are quite different than the actual rates. Now, I would call that fraud, and I would say there's pervasive fraud in the way the major companies are presenting their rates, but we could just call it a discrepancy, maybe there's any number of legitimate reasons for that discrepancy. Now, the question I have is, what about assuming that we can't get these universal comparison data, why not have an odometer requirement so that every user can find out, you know, what their rates are on a standardized basis? Now, clearly, there's a lot of testing services. I go, you know, Comcast promises me 16 megabits on net burst. I've never gotten more than 7 megabits, and I often get much less. So there are, but we can have a standardized approach. Now, clearly, the incumbents have this data because they'll cut me off if I go more than 60 gigabits a month. They know it, and I call up the services. But why not have a universal standard? And then if we have that standard for individuals, we could aggregate it across individuals and come up with general statistical information. But start with the individual, and
okay,
let's have a standard.
Good. Great,
what do
great
people
question.
Think?
Let's close out by giving Dennis and Joe both a chance to respond to that.
Can I come by with an engineer?
Sure. I actually had a question to Brian Robinson. Yeah. He sent me one of his top engineers to come to my house, and we did a test. Actually, my rate was so low at that time, it was because the lawnmower had trimmed the cable, and there was moisture in the line, and I had a dramatic – I wasn't even close to 7 megabits at that time. But anyway.
Stuff happens. I mean, yeah. and that's exactly it. The network is not – no one's network is perfect end-to-end because of human factors like lawnmowers running over cables and what the kid next door might be doing at a given time when you're using your machine. I think the gold standard is our consumers, the mass of consumers, satisfied with what they're getting. And I think the Pew Research, as John Horrigan suggested, said they really are. You can do what you want to do when you want to do it online. And speed is but one component of service. I think the gold standard is, are you getting service? Are you getting what you want and a good value for what you're paying for? And if the market is any indication, the speed with which we are rolling out broadband says that it's a very happy marketplace.
Dennis.
I could add just quickly, 2 points. One is, you know, I've got Rob here who's a happy customer of Fios because he's getting 15 megs. I have other customers who are happy customers of our sort of introductory level broadband service, which is DSL at about 700 and some kilobits for $14.95. A month, so there the market is varied, and the market isn't always you, okay? And so we need to be respectful of that before we charge in with standards that are of our own making. And the other thing is that the market doesn't exist for our amusement, all right? The purpose of having information would be to make our chances of meeting important policy goals, national policy goals, better. And I think extending broadband to places where it isn't meets that test. Making people feel happy about their broadband speeds doesn't meet that test. The market in almost every high-tech market that we look at does an awfully good job of rating products, and there are third-party sources for information about service product quality. I think several people have mentioned that it's fairly easy to test a broadband line. Exactly what it means is open to interpretation. But performing those tests and aggregating them and publishing them is not something that requires government intervention to do, frankly.
All right. Well, with that, please join me in thanking the panel. We'll go right into the next panel here after we rearrange the signs.
Okay. We're going to move into our second panel, which will be a little bit more focused on actual policy questions, what data sort of should be collected and how we might go about it. And this time our order is random. And so we will start with Mark Lloyd from the Center for American Progress.
Oh, is that right? Much of what it was that I would have any interest in saying has already been said. The last panel was really quite excellent. So what I'm going to do is just sort of spout my views about some of these things. Which are that part of what we need is a very clear definition for broadband services, which is not necessarily a technical definition, but is the definition that I think is really embodied in 706 that Derek talked about a little earlier. So in other words, if a consumer understands that they're supposed to get full motion interactive service with high definition video over broadband and they're not getting it, then they should know they're not getting broadband service. That's not about the speed. That really is about whether or not they've got a service that, again, delivers full motion, real-time, interactive video over what's being called broadband. Now, I don't think you get that at 200 kilobits per second, two ways. And you may be able to get that, you know, with the service that's delivering, I don't know, 5 megs or, you know, maybe even 2.5 megs a second, depending on your capability at home. But if you're at home and you know you're not getting it, you know you've got a problem. And so I think starting with, which is part of what NOA's bill does. So trying to define the service rather than the exact speed may be a better approach. The other thing that I would say is that I was with the Alliance for Public Technology when we fought, and Henry Geller and Barbara O'Connor and a wide variety of other folks were there sort of fighting for 706, and it was quite a battle lobbying to get that included in the 1996 Telecommunications Act. I think it's really excellent law that it's been horribly abused by the Federal Communications Commission. The Federal Communications Commission simply is not reporting the deployment of advanced telecommunications services in the United States. It's just not doing it. Both Bill Kennard and Gloria Tristani complained about this in 2000. This is not a new issue. This didn't just come up when OECD started issuing its rankings. Again, both Kennard and Tristani complained about this in 2000. We need to do a much better job of really answering what it is that Congress required the FCC to answer in 1996. That's not happening. And finally, I mean, I really just want to note that I think it's extraordinarily important for private organizations, whether it is Pew or whether it is Kagan or whether it is Connect Kentucky or whatever the group is, to collect data, to test and challenge what it is that we've got at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, to do the surveys, to do reports on speed matters. You know, having private entities do this is extraordinarily important. I think, again, we went through a debate in getting 706 passed that suggested there is a role for the federal government to make federal policy in determining whether or not there ought to be gaps filled here and there and whatever the areas, and doing that as well. Having Connect Kentucky doesn't suggest we can't have states collecting data. It doesn't suggest that we can't have Pew collecting data. It doesn't suggest that there can't be other entities that are responsible for collecting data. Again, we've been through this debate. We settled this in 1996, but a lot of other things we thought were settled in 1996. Unfortunately, I think, and again, Rob has said this earlier, I mean, the one thing that I think is pretty clear, without regard to how pristine the data is, in 2000, we were at 4, and we were concerned about our collection of data. 2007, we're 12 or 15, we're certainly not 4, and we're still concerned about the collection of data. This is not rocket science. We ought to be doing a much better job, and the fact that we're not, I think, is a demonstration of, if anything, agency capture. And so we need to make sure that we are actually delivering full motion, interactive, two-way, high-definition video, not because that's going to make consumers happy, right, but because that might actually address healthcare needs. It might actually address a wide variety of environmental needs, that if people can stay at home, they're not driving their cars to work. It might address some of our educational needs. it might address some civic needs that we have in this nation. And so, again, the idea that somehow if consumers are happy, everything is okay, we need to begin to set policies based on other needs that we have in this country. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Our second speaker, we've been hearing a lot about Connect Kentucky so far. In fact, we now have somebody from Connect Kentucky who will talk about the program.
Thanks, Scott. I can get this going. No, I don't want normal. What do I want? Slideshow. There we go. Okay. Thanks. It's not every day that I get to come and talk strictly about data collection and research. We talk about lots of other things every day, so it's great to be here. The Connected Nation model, it's a model for technology expansion, but as has kind of been referred to during the first panel, and the point that I want to make about our data collection and our research is that every piece of data that we collect and the research that we do is collected for a specific purpose. The purpose of the model and the clear goals that are set for any state initiative is to drive community and economic development. That's our end game. That's what we're ultimately getting to. So, of course, that's what our research and our data collection is going to do as well. The model itself was developed in Kentucky through the Connect Kentucky project that's been mentioned. We're now operating in Tennessee as well through Connected Tennessee, and we're engaged now with multiple states as we kind of work with them to help identify needs and resources and help put together programs at the state level that might follow this model if that's the way that the state and the providers within the state want to go. The model is unique in that it uses a collaborative public-private partnership approach to work both supply and demand simultaneously. So on one hand, to map the broadband data, the deployment data, as opposed to subscribership data that we heard about, but also to through this mapping process, that the key point is to identify those gaps in service. What we're really concerned about and focused on are those unserved areas. So that's what we look at from a supply side. From a demand side, we work through local grassroots technology planning teams to drive demand, and then we have a research structure established to provide a foundation for the work for those local teams. So the data then we collect it falls in two camps, the supply side, the availability data, and then the demand side, the consumer data. Whoop, I don't have anything in between. I'm not sure how well you can see all the color differentiation here, but this is the Kentucky broadband map. It's a little bit fuller and richer at this point than the Connected Tennessee map because we're in the beginning phases with Connected Tennessee. But to map availability and then more importantly to map those service gaps, we rely on providers to collectively supply information that then allows us to geographically map the service availability. So again, this is deployment data. This is not subscribership data. It actually allows us to look and see where broadband exists and then where it does not, so where folks can get access and then where they can't. We can then drill down. I'll show this map. We can then drill down into those unserved areas to look at, to analyze, really, those unserved areas and to work collaboratively with the providers and the community leaders and then potential providers in that area to look at things like household density or terrain or proposed infrastructure, aggregated or created demand through the local teams, planned applications, planned investment, anchor tenants, whatever it is that we need to look at in order to help build the business case for deployment in those unserved areas and encourage providers to get there, to also help identify the most cost-effective and appropriate broadband technologies for any particular area because they drastically differ depending on what area we're looking at, and then also to put together all of this data and all of this information and the way that these unserved areas look to help establish public-private partnerships to lever at the local level to leverage resources to then identify both federal and state resources that we can work together with private resources to encourage deployment. So that's what it looks like from a supply side. On the demand side, in terms of the consumer type data that we collect, there are really two ways that we do this. First is through those local teams that I talked about, and I'm not going to go into the process, although I would love to, of how those local teams work, and I'd be happy to answer questions on those if anybody has them. But at the end of the day, every local community has a localized strategic technology plan for how they are going to use technology moving forward. This process works not only to validate the map from a supply side, and then, of course, to drive community and economic development from the bottom up, which is really what we're getting at, but also it also supplies a wealth of data for us from a consumer demand standpoint or a consumer adoption standpoint that we can then use to bring together with providers and local leaders to incent deployment, to continue to incent deployment. And then secondly, so this is the local team process. I don't have another slide on telephone surveys, but similar to Pew, we've kind of followed the Pew standard and model in terms of our random dial telephone surveys to try to complement the more quantitative approach through the local team planning through a more quantitative data collection method of telephone surveys at the local level, at the county level. We do this both to guide and direct our work from a program development standpoint, both at a state level and an organizational level, as well as at that local level. But then also, of course, it allows us to benchmark adoption levels, track barriers to adoption, track it across demographics, and then work across the board to ensure that our research or that our work continues to be research-driven and targeted and effective and actually identifies local problems and then creates solutions that target those specific needs for those specific areas. Just to give you some kind of idea very quickly on kind of how this has played out in Kentucky, from a mapping standpoint, we've gone from about 60% coverage in 2004, which is when the project started, to 93% of households that can now subscribe to broadband. That's actually from March. We collect this data quarterly, and we update it quarterly, so we're just about to release our latest Q2 map, which will hopefully have ticked up that 93%. And then from an adoption standpoint, one more thing I'll mention from a supply side, we've also been able to track the private investment, which is really a huge measure of adoption. So we know that over $650 million in private capital investment for telecom infrastructure has been invested in Kentucky over the course of that period. And then finally for adoption, we've got a 73% increase in home broadband adoption over the last couple years, 20% increase in computer use. So we're able to track those kind of things as well and then put that all together to try to drive supply as well as demand. The very last thing I'll say, because I need to stop, is that I never really got to what we would recommend at a federal level. And really what we would hope to see is the enabling for states to put together, to have more resources on hand to put together these same type of programs at a state level because they have been shown to be successful. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Laura. Next we have Beth Hiroshi from AT&T.
Thanks. It's hard to fit in 7 minutes all this stuff because I think everybody feels so passionate about all the different aspects. So I want to go back to kind of the title of the panel and what kinds of broadband data collection policy should the U.S. employ. And I think before we answer that, we really have to think about what are we trying to do with this data and what point are we trying to make. And I would submit that there's really two purposes and two views. I think that as policymakers, we have to have an eye towards the future, and we have to be looking at what do we really need, where do we need our country to go, and where do we need our citizens to go. And I think that's where you get into the high speed, high application, what are the future possibilities that we have to start laying the groundwork for now or have already started laying the groundwork for. But then I think we also have to remember that really, this is not just about the future. It's also about now and what a consumer's saying. And sometimes in all the research, I think we skip right over that because we say, oh, they don't know what their speeds are. We can't talk, you know, we can't use data that consumers give us because they really don't know that much about what they're doing and what they're using. And I would submit that that's not perhaps altogether the right way to look at it. They are the ones with the wallets, and they are the ones that buy. And one of the problems that I think we have in this country is, yes, we have an availability issue, and we have areas that are unserved, but where we have availability, even with multiple providers, we have a substantial chunk of the country that's not purchasing. And why is that? Why are consumers not buying it, and why are they happy on dial-up? I think that on the first panel we heard a little anecdotal evidence, which is you don't know how much you dislike what you have until you move up. So how do we convince people to move up to the next product set to realize what they really want? From a kind of eye towards the future perspective and the data collection, I think it's vastly important that we get to a place where we collect data that is consistent, that all providers provide data. And I think one of the things we really need to look at is third-party collection of that data. Providers giving input is important, but it's also we've seen some of all the criticisms of data has been, you know, well, it wasn't consistent, or they changed their methodology, or providers weren't providing, and then they started changing who had to provide. And I would submit that a third-party application like Connect Kentucky that works with those providers on the ground is an excellent way to make sure that you encompass all the different opportunities and broadband applications and not just certain providers that happen to be under the regulatory thumb of a certain agency. I think we also have to really be careful with the confidential nature of the data because this is a competitive marketplace. And so what we require of providers and what we ask of providers has to be held at the highest confidential standard, or else you really have no incentive to have providers work with you to provide that data as we're out competing for end users. Back to kind of what consumers are saying, I think we've really got to dig down into what do we do to get computers in the hands of homes that don't have them. When people have computers and they're on dial-up, how do we convince them? What do we do to educate consumers that broadband holds a better possible future and applications for them? And when we look at that, I think affordability is an issue. I think that we have to look at low income, you know, income levels and what we can do there. And I think that we really have to round out that entire gamut, because even if we get availability to 100% of our end users, which AT&T obviously will do by the end of this year, you still only have 40 to 45% penetration. And so what do we do to raise that bar, and what do we do from an education standpoint to convince customers?
Thank you. Our next speaker is Claire Kay, who's from Cumberland Internet, which is a small wireless internet service provider in Cumberland County, Illinois. I don't know what Claire is going to say yet, but this is definitely a perspective that we haven't heard yet. So, Claire.
Well, let me first say thank you for inviting me. I'm fascinated with how much data is being analyzed about a little business that we're a part of. I'm encouraged that people are very interested in broadband, and specifically in rural areas, because I've lived in a city and I've lived in a country setting, and it means a very different thing in a rural setting than it does in a city setting. So it does mean economic opportunity to people who otherwise wouldn't have it. And it's as simple as somebody selling something on eBay. Makes a big difference. So we provide service in all of one county and part of two counties. And I know that you want real information. And I think small ISPs are important to closing the gaps where there are holes in coverage. I would love to be able to look at a map and see where gaps are as a business person and be able to target that area as a place that I want to reach. I think the information that's being gathered now is not useful to somebody like me because it's obfuscated. I don't know who the competitors are. I don't know what they're really providing. And I think that's the same complaint that the consumer would have that I've heard already, where people say they have 13 providers available, but they really have one. So in the spirit of getting correct information, I would prefer something where ISPs or any provider could self-post to something that's a Google-type interactive geographic information system where you could draw the areas you actually cover. Whether it covers two zip codes or parts of one, it's not that hard. What's available now in geographic information systems would account for it. And I think if you look at what's been done with the 911 systems, there's already a framework for a lot of the maps and the customers in those areas. If something like that were available, I think that you could advertise to consumers that, hey, go to this map and see if you have coverage in your area. I think there should be a feedback mechanism where you could challenge the data, where somebody says, they say they provide area in my circle, they don't. Now, I don't know if it would just be something that's posted in the same in the same database where you could just look at it, or whether it would create some sort of a loop back in validating whether their information is correct. If I were a provider in an area and I posted that I offer service, I think I should have consumers challenge me if I don't. In that same spirit, I could offer or choose to put up information for price and speed. If I choose not to, then it isn't up there. But you researchers would now have a point of contact. If you want more information for, say, a Connect Kentucky research project or any other research project, I think right now we know there are gaps. And I think it's true that we have a lot of small providers that really aren't being represented in the data. And we want to be available to customers. I mean, we spend money on advertising to reach them. So if there were some type of a database like this where people would upload their information, maybe the best thing for policymakers to do would be to promote consumers to go to this page. You know, just a simple advertising campaign, consumer information advertising campaign that says, do you have coverage? Go here. And if you don't, you can challenge it. And if there's enough challenges, I think that somebody should see if they should be able to post their information. So I'm advocating a market solution, self-posted. And I think that something to remember in all this data collection is to drive policy. And I think as a small provider, really out of the, we don't take universal service fund money. We're not trying to reach the whole world. We want to reach our world well. I think that it's important to remember that all policy should do no harm to small providers, because we are the only people who are really going to fill in the gaps. And just as an example, in my state, when we were first starting to grow, one of the obvious customers for broadband service was our local government offices or our schools. And we said, hey, we're homegrown technology users. You know, you have people right here. If you need to reach us, we're just down the street, or you can talk to me at the grocery store. I'll see you at the gas station. So, but the state of Illinois, in its quest to reach a higher level of, I guess, broadband penetration or network usage, sifted off all those customers from us by building a competitive, to me, a network that competed with me. They used preferential tariffs that were available only to them, and built a network in the state of Illinois to connect schools and other government buildings. So I say, remember that small providers are important, and if you kill us now, we won't be here when you need us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our final speaker here is Drew Clark, who has now changed hats and will speak as a panelist.
Thank you. So thank you for this great panelists that you've spoken. You've given some great perspective. I want to tell you very briefly about the Center for Public Integrity's media tracker. This is part of the project that I'm responsible for called the Well Connected Project, and it's available at the URL you see below. When I joined the center last August, I saw broadband as a natural extension of the media tracker. Let me go ahead and go forward here. Media tracker is pretty simple. You type in your zip code and you press go. This is what you get. You have an overview of media competition, the types of media, owners of media, broadcast towers mapped on a geographic display, and detailed tabs with more information. Television. This is the view where you see the number of commercial licenses, network, educational, low power, and all the companies that provide broadcast service, where what we've done is linked FCC data with Securities and Exchange Commission data with other forms of data to produce this result. Similarly with radio, we have a view of the AM dial, the FM dial, the companies, and what they own. Cable, we do the same thing, tap into a separate FCC database. This matches up the names of the franchises for the area searched, Swisher, Iowa, in this zip code. And it also, because sometimes it doesn't catch every name properly, we list all of the registered cable communities within Johnson County. And just by typing in your zip code, we know the city and the county you're in, obviously. Newspapers, we are able to show you the companies and link to the website. So if you want to know, you know, all the newspapers within 100 miles of this location, just go to that location. You got external links to all those sites like that. Okay, so broadband is what we're here talking about today. The FCC reports that there are 1 to 3 broadband providers that service Swisher, Iowa. 1 to 3. Okay, we don't know how many. It's 1, 2, or 3. We don't know who they are. We do know that there are 1 to 3, and we do know that within Johnson County, there are 5 zip codes that have 1, 2, 3 providers, 1 that has 5 providers, and so forth. Again, according to the FCC data, which is from the Form 477s that have been discussed. Now, I discussed earlier that the center uses Freedom of Information Act frequently, and in the packet that you have here, there is information about the lawsuit that we filed against the Federal Communications Commission to get the Form 477 data. Now, the reason we wanted to get the Form 477 data is essentially twofold. And the first has been, actually, they've both been talked about here, but just to articulate them separately, one is to get better quality data for policymaking purposes. If we were able to know who those 1, 2, or 3 providers in 52338 are, you'd be able to check. Well, do they really serve me who lives in 52338? Or do they not? Are they just serving a business in a faraway corner of the zip code? Or are they serving me? As has been discussed, when the GAO did its analysis of the FCC data with access to the Form 477s, they were able to determine that the median number of providers in a zip code was 2 instead of 8. That's a big difference. And again, better data would help drive that analysis. The second point, however, is not just better data for the FCC to know in its wisdom, but for you, the consumer, to know in your wisdom and to be able to do something with that data. I mean, maybe it's as simple as, oh, I know who to go to. I know the external links of the 3 or 2 or 1 broadband providers, but you have something you can act on. And as has been spoken about by many people, there are things that can be built on top of that. There are mechanisms where someone can say, oh, this is the speed I get. This is the price I pay for the service. I'm satisfied. I'm not satisfied. Now, it's a long way from there to statistically relevant information, but it's a start based on something solid. And I guess that's really one of the key points I want to make, that when we talk about the difference between the bottom-up approaches and the top-down approaches, I think that both have value, but what we're trying to do at the center is to have a solid basis of fact underline whatever people add on top of. We know for sure that there are X providers in this zip code, and these are their names. Let me just quickly show you some of the other things you can get in the media tracker. Once you click on one of the companies, you can obviously click on the media companies here, but you'll be able, if we are able to get this data, click on the telecom companies and see a complete list of the facilities, perhaps a complete list of the zip codes in which the company offers service. And then we link this to political influence, the political contributions and the lobbying expenditures and the privately funded trips and soon the FCC lobbying activities of each of the media and telecom companies that are participating in our communications network. We also have reporting, investigative journalism, and more quick turnaround stories. And finally, we combine that with financial information from the SEC. Now, I want to address, just in the final 2 or 3 minutes, the question about confidentiality, because that's been raised. And I think that it's probably the case that there is some information in those Form 477 forms that many people would consider confidential, such as the number of subscribers in each zip code. And in our arguments in the federal court case that we filed, we've argued both that, well, if you don't find them confidential, you can release them in a range. But if you do find them confidential, there's no reason why you can't simply release the names of the providers within each zip code. And as many people have spoken about already, that's the kind of thing that companies want to get out. I mean, AT&T, for example, on its website, has an ability for you to type in your zip code. You can see if AT&T provides broadband service. You can go to Singular's website, and you can type in your zip code. You can see with that wireless carrier where they offer service. And so I guess I'm just a little bit perplexed as to why some of the major carriers, and I'd love to be enlightened, Beth, if you have anything to add, why they are opposed, on the one hand, to the release of a limited set of the Form 477 data while providing it on their website. Is it that, you know, there's a system of confidentiality to even where the zip code, what zip codes you're providing service, or is it that you feel that you'd rather them come to the AT&T website than see it at another website? And I guess really the final question or comment I throw out there is for Laura, and it's, you know, when you work with the companies, I understand that you promise, you know, you won't disclose which zip codes are offering service, and that is an important selling point, as I understand it, for Connect Kentucky. But once you do the map and you're showing that there's service, you're identifying the type of service, you're identifying the technology, and that would clearly show what the FCC and some of the carriers are claiming is confidential information. So I'm just, again, trying to sort of square this circle and understand the disconnect. If getting broadband information is good and we wanted to get it out there, why is it not good to have the zip codes identified where people do provide service? Thank you.
Thanks, Drew. Before we go to questions, the Form 477 issue, that's not, I don't think that's your area, Beth, but if you wanted to respond to what Drew said, please feel free to go ahead. And Laura, I'd be interested in hearing your response.
Sure, and I think there's several issues, and I don't want to speak explicitly to the current open case, but I mean, I think there's a couple of different issues, one being the data on the Form 477 does contain a lot more than just what you're seeking, and so certainly there's precedent setting that goes on with those types of court cases. I think the other differential, when we work with Connect Kentucky, as we did in Kentucky, we have worked with them to provide certain input of data, and then Connect Kentucky actually makes assumptions about certain things. So, you know, while we think that the map is very valid and we agree with a lot of the assumptions set, that is an independent methodology, and it's not exactly the same as providing the data on the Form 477. That said, I do think that, you know, the ability of our website to have the marketing capabilities also has qualifiers around it. It does a sweep based on certain inputs. It does not guarantee availability. It does not guarantee that you can get service. It is an assessment tool, and then the customer obviously comes to the company to talk about whether service is actually available on that loop. So I think there are a lot of different variations, and they're not all apples for apples.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Beth mentioned, because that is the way that the mapping works. What we collect from providers is actually infrastructure data on their deployment their areas of deployment. And it is confidential and proprietary data that we have to work with them to release, and we sign non-disclosure agreements with those providers. We don't ever release that data that they give us, those inputs. We actually kind of scrub it and then use those inputs to convert those into a coverage map, which is really what everybody's wanting anyway from both a policy and state standpoint as well as in a citizen standpoint as well as providers who want to see where those service gaps lay. The other key point, I think, is that from a connected nation standpoint is that this process that we undertake from a mapping perspective is aligned and works simultaneously with the demand creation process. So providers both providers and communities and policymakers have skin in the game, but providers are excited about the process because they understand that we're working to support their business plans and to drive deployment where it makes most sense for each specific provider for each specific region.
I'm going to abuse my role as moderator just to ask Laura a few more questions about Connect Kentucky. I'm curious, three questions, actually. How are communities defined, and how do they select into this program? Do the communities select, or are they sort of selected by somebody else? And second, how do you sort of interact with small providers like Claire's company? And third, there's a lot of talk about Connect Kentucky as a possible model. Do you think it scales up? It seems very labor-intensive.
Yeah, those are great questions. The first one, communities. We work with every community across the state. So it really depends on how a state wants to define a community because different states work different ways and are structured different ways. In Kentucky, for example, it's very county-based. So everything was set up according to counties. There are 120 counties in Kentucky, which is kind of insane. And so there are 120 local technology planning teams and now 120 local technology strategic plans. That's how it worked best for Kentucky. In Tennessee, it's working along the same lines because Tennessee is pretty county-based as well. In some states that we're talking to, it's not as much county-based. It's much more city-based. Either they don't have counties really at all to speak of, or it's just not, you know, set up that way. So it really just depends on the state makeup. But the key point, though, is that it is comprehensive, and we want to ensure that every community is considered regardless of the geography. However that community is structured is included and has its own locally owned technology plan. The second question, small providers, like Claire, one of the key pieces to success for this model is that every provider is included and every provider has a seat at the table, no matter how small. In fact, smaller providers have been a key piece of the solution for these rural areas. And it's not until every sector of the community, so it's actually at least 9 sectors of the community that we work to represent within these teams, as well as, you know, all the providers and potential providers in that community. It's not until they're all coming together to find solutions that we can really identify the best and most cost-effective solutions for each area. So they absolutely play a role. And then what was the third question, Scott?
Scale.
Scale. That's interesting because we started in Kentucky and we wanted to, a lot of us are based in Kentucky, and in fact our operations from a mapping and research and communication standpoint are still based in Kentucky. But we wanted to ensure that we could tweak the program, get it right. We knew up front that it could be scalable and it was structured that way through the research that we developed on the front end. But we did not want to take it to other states until we could ensure that we got it right in one state and ensure that it was, in fact, scalable. So the way that we have done that is we've set up a system to allow us to expand into other states, and it is actually it's a little more scalable from a mapping standpoint than it is from any other standpoint because you've got to have boots on the ground from a local community technology planning perspective, and that's what really takes a lot of the resources and effort, but it is certainly doable.
Hey, let's take some questions. Wait for the microphone and then identify yourself, please.
I'm Peter Backoff from the Alliance for Public Technology again. I wanted to follow up on Mark's comments because I think there's something important at sort of a baseline assumption, and it affects how you count this data and what it's used for, and that's
there's a lot of talk about markets, consumers, product packages, all these other things, but I think Section 706 elevates this beyond a normal consumer electronic. This is not a VCR or a CD player. And so I think that we need to ask, we certainly need to think about this a little bit differently in the sense that asking about consumer satisfaction with broadband right now is a little bit like asking about consumer satisfaction with the interstate system in 1953. We don't really know what it's going to be used for, what the full benefits are going to be until it gets to be the full-scale universal deployment that's mandated in the law right now. So I just wanted to comment about that and how I mean, private companies are obviously important because that's how we built all the infrastructure so far, but how does that work? Is it a market? It's not a marketplace. It's not a pure marketplace. And so I think we need to address that question and think about that in terms of how we collect data. So
any response?
I'll just comment a little bit to what you said. I mean, I do think that there are areas where obviously, for whatever reason, it's hard to get the market there. It's either rural, it's high cost, the geography, the terrain, whatever. And we have recently proposed an FCC pilot. Dennis is going to go a little apoplectic, so I'm glad he's not on the panel to combat me, for a USF-based pilot program for broadband. And so I think that's one way that we see a potential solution for those areas. And it is currently limited, our proposal, to a pilot to see if it works before we expand, because I think that maybe we've all learned a little bit about testing something before you go full bore in funding.
Right here and then in the back.
Rick Zimmer with NCTA. I was just moved to comment if I could. I mean, I'm not sure that that we all have the same understanding of Section 706 as Peter, because it's the second time that he mentioned that there's a mandate for universal deployment, which is not what it says. It says make it as widely available as possible. If there were a mandate for deployment, the FCC has had the opportunity to do that in the context of universal service, which under the rules they haven't been able to do. There's a four-part test. Is it, does it meet the standard? Do enough people subscribe, et cetera, et cetera? Not to get into all the details here, there have been various bills to fund. It is not a universal mandate for deployment. So what it is, encouragement, and that's something that certainly we all agree with. I thought it was fascinating to Joe's point that 94% of America is served by cable with broadband today, that the three people that mentioned they only had one provider all said cable was available to them, so we're proud of that. But just to harp on his point from before, the key is where is it not available, and then how do you get it to those people? So my key point is just I think there's a fundamental difference in my understanding of what Section 706 actually says and does than perhaps what some other people have claimed.
Yeah, if I could respond, I mean I think actually Derek sort of set it out correctly. I would not describe 706 as a mandate for deployment. What 706 says is that the FCC is required every 2 years to report to the Congress and the public on the state of deployment of advanced telecommunication services in the United States. There are many of us who read 706 as a statute where Congress expressed special concern about rural areas and would read that into the legislative history of 706. And there are a number of us who would read 706 as to suggest that the FCC is to propose solutions if it determines with the data that things are not being deployed in a reasonable and timely basis. But I wouldn't describe that. I'm not sure I disagree with your point at all. I wouldn't describe that as a mandate to deploy, because you know, who's going to be forced to deploy? I think the point is well taken. And again, to sort of quote from Derek, or maybe it was Drew who started out by saying, you know, how can you manage what you can't measure? We certainly want to encourage private industry, whether it's cable, telecom, satellite, or whomever, to deploy advanced telecommunication services. But if they don't, we need to know where the gaps are to fill. And if we don't know where the gaps are to fill, how do we know that the government has a role to play there? You know, how do we know, you know, whether or not, you know, public-private partnerships ought to be encouraged to support, you know, small industry to help fill in the gaps? And if we don't If we don't have the basic data, how do we know? And again, as Derek suggested at the beginning, the definition in 706 is broad, but it's focused on application. It's focused on two-way advanced telecommunication services, including the delivery of video. And so the FCC data simply doesn't get us to that.
There was a question in the back.
Yes, this is from Ms. Taylor. I'm Philip Weber with the Congressional Budget Office. I'm just curious about the relationship, how the USF, since you all have probably the best data, actual data of anybody, how has the USF played a role in bringing broadband to Kentucky? Three-quarters of the small rural telephone companies say, file before the FCC, say they provide broadband in their area of service. So I was just curious, do you all, where do you find the gaps? Do you find the USF, the monies for the USF, in fact, do bring broadband to people? Since you're the vice president of research, I thought you'd probably looked at the numbers. And rather than just describing the process by which you get those numbers, I'd be a little bit interested in what are you actually finding, other than 93% and hopefully this quarter 97% or 93%+ will have it.
All right. No, I appreciate the question. What we have found in Kentucky is that USF, although it certainly plays a role, it has not really been the solution that I don't want to say the solution that we'd hoped, but it really has not played out in terms of our data as we would have suspected. What has really been the driving force in terms of deployment and the ability for companies to serve rural areas, and you know, there are different pieces of USF that I can speak to, but what really has served as that driving piece has been the public and private sectors coming together to find solutions for those unserved areas. It really hasn't been now there are federal pieces that have played a role for sure, and we've worked to identify those. Those have mainly played out in the form of RUS grants, not as much the loan program. The loan program has not been nearly as relevant, but the grant program has for Kentucky. But in terms of USF, there's really not a whole lot of analysis that we have done because it really hasn't played a significant role in rolling out to that last mile or those last few areas. It may have up until that point. We just haven't done that analysis because we have focused on those rural unserved areas.
Any additional question?
Can I make another point? I think that the USF and its application to broadband is clearly a huge issue, lurking under this debate, and that's clearly going to need to get sorted out at some point. And while I think that is an important driver of this discussion of broadband data, I think it's also important not to neglect other issues like the speed and the price, too. And, in presentations on the first panel, there's some discussion of the importance of including those when we compare the U.S. against the rest of the world, or just when we look at objectively at the state of our broadband. And the importance of having the company-level information is that you can then add on, okay, well, this is what this person's experience is with the speed, this is what this person's experience is with the price, and that's the kind of data that comes from users that simply wouldn't be possible if all you had was the number of providers in a particular area.
Okay, well, I think with that one more quick question. Yes, please, Jim.
Okay, thank you. Jim McConaughey, NTIA, salute you on Connect Kentucky. It's been a fabulously successful program. Quick question, the 93% coverage figure, is that based on 200 kilobits per second broadband definition?
Yeah, this is kind of a moving target for us because we don't have a hard and fast threshold. We set it up that way for a purpose. I mean, if there's any definition that we would have to fall back on, I guess it would be the FCC definition, but we really don't. We wanted on the front end not to box ourselves in, and we did it purposely because our focus is to ensure that residents that don't have any other access besides dial-up can get something that is dramatically different from what they have now. In most every case for deployment over the past 2 to 3 years, it has been far and above the 200K. So far and above that, you know, I mean, most of that has been either wireline or, and then in some cases, fixed wireless, which is a key solution for that area, or for some areas where wireline doesn't make sense or that it's not feasible. But what we can do at that point, because it is a very localized process, when those providers and those communities are coming together to figure out what solution does work best, we can serve as kind of a arbitrator of sorts for them, for those communities, to assure them that this is the type of quality, you know, this is the quality and this is the type of service that the provider is saying they're going to provide and that you're going to get. So while sometimes it means wireline, sometimes it means fixed wireless, in all cases, our role is to ensure that it's something that is significantly better than what they've got now and that allows them to interact with government, to further economic development, and ideally, of course, to have interactive two-way video, full motion video. So that's our ultimate goal. Better and faster is always ideal, but we want to ensure that right now, today, we can get those communities something dramatically better than what they've got.
Thank you.
We're finishing up right at noon, right on the dot. First, I want to thank the National Academies for letting us use this room. I was on a committee, and it's one of the perks of being on a committee. I guess they let us use the facility. I'm very pleased with that. We just did a report on software dependability. Buy it now. Thank me later. I want to thank everyone for coming, and please join me in thanking our panelists for their very interesting comments.